Sorry, you were saying you watched Martin Bergen build his four-decker?
Yeah.
How did he build it, you were saying?
Well, he built it all alone, and he'd pull the logs up as it got higher. He'd build a ramp out of logs, and then he'd go on and climb up the ladder and get up there and pull the log up, set it, and go back down. And he... When he died, they found all sorts of money in old shoeboxes and everything like that. He never believed in banks. I don't know where he got his money. He asked old Peg Wise to marry him one time. She says, "I wouldn't marry you, you dirty old man, if you're the last man on earth."
He was quite awesome.
Yeah, Martin Bergen. He built that, and he built the next one, the little, is it two stories or,
right,
or one?
Yeah. You know, that's been designated municipal historic
site. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So getting back to pilots there, I think we were talking about George Simmons, I guess, and his, you were saying he first started flying because he...
Well, I don't know, I forget now why he decided to start flying, but he had a mink ranch out there on the Tagish Lake, the main arm.
Right.
And he... learned to fly, and I think he brought a plane in, put it on float so he could service the mink ranch. And then he started flying over to Atlin and got a bit of a charter license and so on, and went from there.
So among the BYN pilots, were there any that were thought to be the better of the pilots? Or?
Well, I think they were, most of them were pretty good. They had a couple of duds. A fellow named Len Pope, he was lasted a month or two, but they had originally they had like Bob Randall and Ev Wasson and Les Cook eventually, and Les Cook was originally with George Simmons, Northern Airways.
How was it that he came to come over?
Well, he got a better offer. He did. He came over to White Pass. I don't know. I guess he figured it was more secure or something. Bigger deal. And then he quit them and went with the American Air Force on the Norseman.
And when would that have been? After CP took over, I guess, or even with when it was BYN? Must have been CP, I guess.
Yeah, I think so.
Because the Americans, were they in
it? Because it was, yeah. Les Cook was killed in 42, I guess it was.
December 42, 40, wasn't it? Yeah.
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 And, and that was Canadian Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And,
they had
Von Woods was a good pilot, but he killed himself before he had a chance to prove much.
He would have been your age, I guess.
Oh, he's older than me. But he and I bunked in together on the boat on the way up, because he was getting his commercial in Vancouver, and that's where I first met him. He said, "Why don't you write to Bill Ancombe?" I'd never heard him.
Mm-hmm.
So they hired me, and he and I shared a stateroom on the old Princess Nora.
Mm-hmm. So among the other pilots and the rest of the Yukon in 1942, were there any other sort of leading lights that stood out?
Ernie Kubicek was sort of the main pilot, and Alec Dame, of course, he had a fairly short career, the Beechcraft deal. We ran out of gas and went into the trees.
And what did Alec do after that?
He went with the Transatlantic Ferry Command, and he was killed when he started, I think, just out of Montreal, mm-hmm. ferrying Lockheed Hudson's.
Right.
A beautiful wife. They had two or three kiddies, and she married another pilot named Jaguar, Fred Jaguar, and then he killed himself flying. And she married another one, and she's been up here this past year, and Bob's got pictures of her when he was bringing the Fokker up. She's an elderly grandmother now, but
mm-hmm.
she was a real doll when she was first married to Alec. And I can't think of any We didn't have that many pilots then. As a matter of fact, Ernie Kubasek was the main one.
And did you ever fly with Grant McConachy?
I never flew with him, but he used to come in here. He was on the, you know, when they first started the Yukon Southern run in the Barclay Groves, he'd fly some of the trips. Mm-hmm. But I flew with Holly Kenyon and Bill Emery and Bob. Well, I don't know that I ever flew with Bob Camp. But.
Mm-hmm. So, shifting over to focusing a bit more on the military and the war, was there an immediate reaction here or to Pearl Harbor? Or
well, I don't think so. That was sort of what made the Alaska Highway go right now.
Right, but folks in Whitehorse, I mean, it's a town of how many folks?
500.
500 sort of thing?
Yeah. Well, and then that was in 41, 42, I think it was in May
December,
or June.
December 41 was Pearl Harbor, of course.
Yeah, but my chum and I, by this time, we both lived in the warehouse there in the freight sheds, and we were visiting people above Taylor and Drury's store Fraser Birkenhead and his wife. They had rented the apartment upstairs. We were hanging out the window, and the train came in, and the soldiers started offloading. We thought, holy smoke. They brought in, I forget how many thousand soldiers, and they set up tents at the north end of the airport. They had a great big colony of them there, and that was the start of the highway from here. And so it was quite, you know, I don't know you call it upsetting or exciting, people of Whitehorse to have all of these bodies suddenly descend on them. And as I say, there was only, I think, about 8 or 10 gals that were, you might say, single gals, eligible gals. So, of course, the gals thought this was terrific. You know, they had the pick of the lot. Anyway.
So what did, what was the reaction of the populace generally to the massive influx of?
Well, I think some of them are probably a little disappointed, because then, you know, you have to start locking doors, and there was a bit of thievery going on, and they'd never had that before, you know. I remember the first time there was a robbery, someone broke into the Northern Commercial Store and stole the safe and everything. They never did find it. But at the same time, the RCMP had dossiers on all these. There were murderers and rapists and everything else come up from the States to work for these contracting outfits, like Metcalf-Hamlin, Kansas City Bridge, and the USED, and all the different contractors that had come up to do different chores up here. So there was all sorts of real bad eggs in the group. They knew about them. They had lists of them. But
and these are civilians you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, booze was. Restricted, you could only get a bottle or two bottles a month, something like that. First of the month, the bloody lineup would be right around the block at the liquor store, and I remember I saw one American soldier pay $100 for a bottle of Gilby's Frosted Gin. I thought, holy smoke! I didn't drink in those days. I said, heck with it. I could sell a bottle of a $6 King's Plate. I could sell for $35 to a cab driver. And so it was much cheaper to not to drink than it was to drink that stuff.
Was there any concern for the safety of the city, concern about attack or infiltrators or anything like that?
Well, we got the usual, you know, advertisement and promotions and loose lips sink ships and so on. And then, of course, they had anti-aircraft guns on the airport, north and south. Every so often they'd have practice, and they'd be boom, boom, boom. And that was always exciting for the local people, but
by and large, people, were they talking about the potential for?
Not, no, never even realized, never even thought about it. You know, I thought, Well, like the Aleutian War, the Forgotten War, as they call it. As far as anybody in the village was concerned, it was, you know, 100 years away, and it wasn't that far away, but never bothered us, never thought about it. And but airplanes, as I say, airplanes are coming through day and night, you know, there'd be rows of them on the airport sometimes, and every type of military thing, and a lot of them going to Russia, and of course they lost a hell of a pile of them going across the straits there to Russia. They didn't believe in warming anything up. They just get in, the thing started, they just opened the throttle and they were gone. And they said in low tide you could walk across the wreckage of airplanes.
Did you, I was reading about a small incident after the Lescott Norseman crash, where one of the firemen who had been attending the fire, after putting away the gear at the fire station, was walking back past the site of the crash and asked a sentry if everything was okay. And so the story goes, and but this fireman was arrested by the American sentry and taken up to the guardhouse and that sort of thing, and released shortly thereafter. But it seemed like a little bit of an odd incident. No. Did you recollect that tale?
My dad and I wandered over there when the thing cooled down, and they were still looking for the bodies, you know, and we were there when they found Les Cook and Don Dixon. Ken McLean had been thrown through the side of the airplane, and a young fellow named Beatty. Get his first name. I'm doing fine, honey. And he was driving the delivery truck for the Northern Commercial. He was just going by the corner when the thing hit. God, he slammed on the brakes, jumped out. And he saw Ken McLean partway out of the side of the fissure, and he rushed over and grabbed and burned it, got his parka burnt and so on, doing so. But Ken, of course, by this time was dead. Dead on impact. But he had apparently been trying to crawl into the back. I guess he could see what was going to happen. He thought he'd get into the back end. I don't know whether that had any effect on the flight or not. But the pilot, Les Cook and Don Dixon, were on top of one another. And they, of course, there were no legs or arms. They were very just... Mm-hmm. The heat of the fire was really hot.
Right. Well, so... with all these military folks around, I guess, you know, building their hangars and flying, I don't know if you call them reams of aircraft, yeah, north to Alaska, did you have much contact with them on the airfield? Or
not too much, really, on the airfield. We had a lot of you know, good friends in the military that were on the Army, had to do with the highway. Mm-hmm. And they'd be over at my folks' place there. Once or twice a week, they love to get into, you know, a home away from the military bit. And they were a great bunch. Well, like, you know, one fellow that you've heard of, Jake's Corner, you know, down here. Well, Jake was a Major Jacobson in the American Army. He used to be over at our place every...
What was his first name?
And he was always just called Jake.
Yeah, anyway.
Major Jacobson.
Right.
And he had a black company that, mm-hmm, built that section from Jake's Corner to Carcross. We're all black.
Was Major Jacobson black?
No. But he was from Alabama.
Right.
And so but he knew how to handle the black boys, and they loved their uniform. They loved to parade. After duty, it was finished during the day. After they finished work, they'd put on the uniform, get out and do precision marching out in front. You know, they loved that.
And they would be based in Whitehorse?
No, they were based out at Carcross.
Right.
And then at another camp on the Tagish River. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then over in the Alaska Highway, and they worked both ways there.
Right. What were your parents' names?
Parents' names?
Yeah, your parents.
My Willard and Jesse Cameron.
Right. And they arrived in Whitehorse in...
They came up first time a year... the following year, I guess. Yeah, a year later.
No.
They came up in the boat, and then they stayed here then. They stayed for a year or so, and then they went back out to Vancouver. My mother didn't like it. Mm-hmm. Dad thought it was great. And then they came back again a few years later, and they stayed for another two or three years. And I set up Arctic Volkswagen, took over the Volkswagen dealership, and my dad and I. His health was pretty poor, so
when
he finally let that go.
When was what did he do when he came up the first time?
He was a liquor vendor. Works at the liquor store.
Right.
Larry Higgins was the territorial agent who was actually in charge of both liquor and the territorial agency. And Larry always maintained if they could sell shack up permits instead of marriage licenses, they'd be rich.
So, if, for instance, the RCAF built a hangar right next to the White Pass, then CPA hangars, I mean, what if the RCAF had a problem, needed a part, the mechanical equivalent of a cup of sugar? Would you see them at your doorstep or vice versa, or they keep to themselves?
I don't recall them ever doing that, but, it'd help one another out. They had to. I don't recall ever having to do anything for them or bumming things from them particularly. But
what type aircraft were the RCAF flying into or flying through Whitehorse?
They had two Norsemen based here. And they were flying a DC-3 on the Sked run between Edmonton and Whitehorse.
Mm-hmm. Who were the pilots on the Norseman?
One of them was Pat Ivy.
Ivy.
Ivey, I think.
Okay.
And the other one was, his name was Crosley. Mm-hmm. They called him the little man. He was a little. But he could really handle a Norseman. They were having a war bond drive, I remember one time, and they had these Norsemen on skis, and he came, made low passes over a white horse in two loops with a great big Norseman. Gee, he did him pretty slick. I said to Pat, I said, why don't you do that? He said, not me, I'm not going to do that. Pat Ivy was the younger guy.
Okay. Yeah.
he was an American up in Canada. And he went with another fellow in Edmonton, and they bought a couple of war surplus Lysanders and went crop spraying, but they couldn't make it. The airplanes were the wrong type, costly to operate, and the farmers weren't that clued into that stuff yet. So he went back, and I lost track of him. He went back to the States, he and his wife.
What would they use the Norsemen for?
Well, they had a camp at Coffee Creek, and another camp at, they went into Dawson and Mayo and these places, and I don't know what all they did, but it was, and they had a couple other camps, I don't know where they were, but they serviced them with the Norsemen. Mm-hmm. DC-3, it went into Coffee Creek, who was it? Mm-hmm. For the bigger loads, I don't know who the hell was flying it.
What was it, Coffee Creek?
There was a camp. I don't know. There must have been a highway maintenance camp, I think, some kind. Mm. Or maybe it was just an emergency airstrip. Mm. I was never in there.
Right. What U.S. Air Force types were based in Whitehorse during the war?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I think I met a few of them. But
sorry, I mean aircraft.
No aircraft based here particularly. During the war.
Lots passing through. And
yeah. That sort of thing. And after the war, they had an officer, a captain usually, and a sergeant. Mm-hmm. And they were the liaison with American aircraft, military aircraft, going mm-hmm. through and being serviced and so on, and then to Alaska and coming the other way. Mm-hmm. And he was, I'm trying to think of his name, Schuyler or something like that. Mm-hmm. Nice guy. And I kind of bugged him, started bugging him. I said, God, I'd like to have a ride in a jet. And, oh, yeah, yeah. So one day I was having coffee down the White Horse Inn, and he came along and said, do you still want to ride in a jet? I said, yeah, come on. So up we went, and it took longer to check me out in the back seat than it did to do the whole bloody flight.
What kind of plane?
It was a F-89 Scorpion, and it was a combination bomber and fighter, big radar nose on it, two cockpits, great big wheels, high pressure wheels, and narrow, and two 7,500 horse jet engines under your butt, ready. And so they finally, I had all of the reset switches, you see, so it took quite a while to check me out in case Skyler called back, and you know, and the intercom said he needed something reset.
Right.
Finally, we took off, and it was great. You know, just the brakes ground, he kicked in the afterburners, and it felt as though somebody just kicked you in the butt a couple times like that. Boy, up we went, and we went down over Carcross, and it was beautiful July day, hot July day, and there was a few cumulus clouds around, and we whipped on up to 25,000-30,000 feet, and he says, well, we better go down and see if we can see any moose. I thought, geez, at this speed, we won't even see the bloody mountain. Down we went, tearing along, and finally he came back, and he said, now I'll show you what a jet penetration is. And so we went back up to 25,000 feet, and he came over the cone there at the LaBarge marker at 25,000 feet. Now he says, suddenly decided I want to land at the White Horse Airport. I said, geez, we could just barely see the thing. So he came back in the throttles, and he dumped the air brakes, the decelerons they call them, and it felt like we'd gone flown into the bush, you know, pulled forward, and he did one turn just like that, right onto the end of the runway.
And you're just showing the spiral,
yep.
One spiral.
Yeah, just hanging like this. But I noticed, after we'd been flying for a while, I thought, I'm too old, I guess, for this. I was about 30, and I could see little snowballs. Yeah, I thought, gee, my eyes are bad. And I also noticed that my one foot was, it was really cold. And I looked down, and there was snow all over it. So I mentioned this to him when we landed, and he kind of laughed. He said, this airplane has a refrigeration system that will refrigerate a five-room house. I said, well, it sure worked me over. But that was quite a ride. You know, we're only up half an hour or so. But he'd do this. An aircraft coming through in order to keep green on his ticket. He'd borrow their helmets and their uniform, their coveralls, and bail into whatever it was.
That would have been a summer day.
Oh, hot summer day, yeah.
And
beautiful day.
Sort of what era? Late 40s, early 50s?
Early 50s.
So, getting back to, keeping with U.S. Air Force types, and do you remember the B-17 that
Carcross?
Bellied in Carcross? Do you remember what the story was there? Or?
Well, I was just reading about it the other day, but a different story to what I heard. The aircraft was sitting unserviceable on the line. These guys had all been partying. There were 16 or 17 of them. And they decided to go for a joyride. Mm. So they climbed in this airplane and they took off. And as I say, it wasn't serviceable. There was carb heat problems and so on. And they got out, heading out towards the coast, and one engine quit. And then another engine quit, and they coming back, decided to see if he could get all the way back. And he knew then he wasn't even going to make it to Carcross. He lost the third engine and finally had it put into the water. And there was George Simmons and another fellow named Gordon Yardley. They were working on their houses, and they saw him come in and hit the water, and they rushed down and grabbed their boat and whipped out and picked up the guys that were floating around, and I think they got seven or eight of them, and there was about the same amount drowned. And then they sent this Norseman out, the one you saw the picture of there, with some doctors.
U.S. Air Force
Norseman. And landed at on Carcross the airport, and he was taken off, and it torqued away on him, and he hit a gin pole that George Simmons had there for lifting aircraft, changed wheels and floats, and he hit that with one wing and cartwheeled and burst into flame and killed the two of them. That was the next day. So it was a sad situation.
Yes, indeed. Shifting now to your interlude, I guess, you had mentioned before that you had decided at some point you were, in 1944 you were going to leave CP. Did you want
CP? Yeah, well, I didn't want to, but they'd taken all our crew, you know. We'd had, there were two crews of six apiece, and they whittled us down to two apiece.
Any rationale given for that, or?
Well, they said, well, war on, we can't afford to be paying all these extra guys and all this sort of stuff. So I leapt off to this fellow, Barney Phillips. He was a vice president of the company. He was a, his uncle had put the money up to get McConaughey started. I never had any use for him at all.
Anyway, is he based in Whitehorse, Mr. Phillips?
No, he was never based in Whitehorse. No. Mm-hmm. But he'd come up all the time up from Edmonton. Mm-hmm. He was McConaughey's right-hand man. Mm-hmm. I liked McConaughey. He was a great guy. Mm-hmm. But so he said to me, you know, you'll put up with it or you'll go and end up in the Army. And I said, yeah, I will, but it'll be my way, not your way. And so I stamped out of there and I got mad and went down and joined up. As I say, I'd only been married a short period of time, and my priorities weren't very good. But I thought, to hell with it, I'm not taking that sort of crap from him.
Right. Who was the boss of the Whitehorse operation at that point? I mean, the person living in Whitehorse. That was
I think it was Russ Baker. I know his 2IC was a fellow named Howard Sugden. Yeah. And Howard said to me, you know, and I said to him, I said, I'm pulling out of here, to hell with it. Well, he said, you know, you can't quit. I said, well, I'm quitting. Well, he said, I'll give you a letter saying that you're on war leave or something like that. I said, well, whatever. So he did. He gave me a letter saying that my job was always there, you know, if I decided to come back.
Right.
So Lloyd Ryder and I were out, and his sister was with him, and my wife, and the four of us kicked around together and went out to the exhibition.
This is in
Vancouver. Yeah.
Lloyd was living in Vancouver at the time?
Yeah, and so he and I, at the same time, said to Howland, we went down to the recruiting office, and we joined up together, and he was K-6803, and I was K-6804. And he ends up, we got split up on a work detail. I was scrubbing walls in a bloody bug-infested hotel there in Vancouver, and he went out to the rifle range, was patching targets, and he took off on the draft before me, and he went overseas, and I never did get overseas.
Right. Where did you take your basic training?
Orillia, Ontario. And I joined up at the Seaforth Barracks in Vancouver.
Really?
And I took my basic in Orillia, Ontario, and I took my advanced in Iprawash, Ontario, mm-hmm. and then I took a course in automotive mechanics at Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And then I was put on an overseas draft, 97, I think it was called. And then the war came to an end. So went over, they posted us to Ordnance Corps in a warehouse, loading up trucks with parts and pieces, junk like that. So then finally I thought, well, I'm not sticking around here for this. So I got a industrial leave, and I showed them my engineer's license and this letter that I had, and they turned around and said, okay, you're still in the Army, but you can go back to work.
So we were just at how the Army had said, well, you got your papers, so you can have an industrial leave.
Yeah, go back. You're still in the Army, but you can go back and go to work. So I came back to Edmonton. And
this would have been in 1945,
46, I guess.
Came back to Edmonton.
Yeah, and then one day the boss in Edmonton.
So it came back to Edmonton to.
To CPA.
CPA to do.
Maintenance.
Right.
Yeah. And the boss said to me one day, he says, "How'd you like to go back to Whitehorse?" I said, "Fine, I'd love it." Okay, there's a vacancy there, so he sent me back up to Whitehorse, and then after a while I left an old beat-up car that I'd bought. I left that for my wife to sell. She sold it. And we had one little boy. That was Bobby. And she came back up.
And this would have been, so 46 still, or 47?
Yeah, I think it was, yeah.
Somewhere in there.
Yeah. I forgot. Anyway, then about within a year, eight or 10 months later, they called me and said to go down to Calgary for your discharge.
Just a quick trip to Calgary.
Yeah.
So when you arrived in Whitehorse, what were you doing?
Well, I went on the line as a crew chief. And
how big an establishment there in terms of
mechanics? It wasn't very big. One fellow and his wife were going out, so we bought the furniture from him.
Right.
And Rex Turpney, I think, was the... I think he was the mechanic, the chief superintendent, and I forget, we had one, two, three, about five or six engineers.
And a like number of pilots based in Whitehorse, or none?
We had some, you know, we still had some 71s this summer and winter, and... Harvey Johnson, one of the pilots, and Phil Iverson, another one, and Jack Chambers, Ernie Krokop, Bill, what the hell's his name? He died just recently. Jack Ferris and Bill Roxborough, and that was about it.
That's quite a few pilots.
Well, that's over a period of, you know,
several years.
A year or two or three. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the aircraft that were based in Whitehorse were, you said, Fairchild 71s.
Yeah, we had Fairchild 71s, and we had, I think at that time we still had a couple of Barclay Groves, because I flew on that. Barclay Grove on the Dawson run with Phil Iverson for a while.
You say you flew on the run, and you would accompany the aircraft from time to time, or?
Well, yeah, as a co-pilot, I suppose you'd call it, sitting in the right-hand seat.
Mm-hmm. Was that sort of the standard procedure then, or was it just on occasion that they'd have an engineer?
No, I think we usually had one every trip, because there was nothing down, there was nobody at Mayo or Dawson to service the aircraft once we got down there.
Right.
So we used to have to gas it and check the oil and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm.
So you had Fairchild 71s and a couple of Barclay Groves.
And then the main line was Lockheed Lodestars.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, then I quit. Quit the outfit in 1951, and went. George Milne and I, he had been a pilot with CPA, and he was starting a little flying service, and so I went with him, and he said, we'll give you a piece of the action. I said, okay. By this time we had two or three kids. So I had asked my wife, I said, do you think we should do this? She said, what would you do if you were single? I said, well, I'd go with him. Well, she said, go with him. I did, and we built up a pretty nice little business. We had a Fleet Canuck and a flying school, and we had a Stinson station wagon. Then we amalgamated with Yukon Flying Service. They were going belly up. We were getting all the business.
So you amalgamated with?
Yukon Flying Service.
Okay.
And business kept getting better, and we bought George Simmons out, who got his Fairchild. And we bought a Beaver, used one. And we had the had Naranja sedan. And we got a added to the school, we got a Cessna 120.
And
then we, one of our partners took off in the 71 of the load for Fuller Lake, and it caught fire over the Quiet Lake Country, and he dove it into the lake and bounced up onto shore and scrammed in a hell of a hurry as it started to burn. And then we tried to pick up some of that load with a little Stinson. Bud Harbottle was flying it, and he hit a cable in Ross River and upset in the river and demolished the airplane. So then George Milne, my main partner, took the Beaver and the same load, still trying to get to Fuller Lake. And it was raining, and a Beaver's very bad in the rain. You can't see much out front. So he's looking out the side. And when he looked up, he was at the end of the lake, and he's shuddering down and slid up into the brush, into the bush, right by the guy's campfire that we'd gone to take the supplies into. So he sat there for a couple of days, and Pat Collison spotted him when he was flying back and forth. Brought some guys in and his Waco, and they manhandled the thing around and pointed it to the lake, and George opened the throttle and got back in the water. Didn't do any damage to the airplane, but the insurance company, by this time, our insurance agent was out of his mind because we had already lost to him all in the same week.
So you went, you got the 71 and then the Stinson.
Yeah, we had the Stinson originally.
Wrapped it on the way to get you.
Yeah.
And then that was the wire at Pelly, was it?
Or was that at Ross River.
Ross, sorry. And then
yeah.
And then the Beaver at the actual campsite, was it?
Mm-hmm.
That you were trying to get
mm-hmm.
to?
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And that was
FHA.
The Beaver. Okay.
FHA was number 15. FHB was number 1. Everybody could try and figure that out. Well, FHB was the initials of one of the design engineers.
Right, of course. So, Yukon Flying Service, who were the principals in that?
George Milne.
No, Yukon Flying Service?
No, Yukon Flying Service. No, that was...
Yukon Airways, they called it.
Yukon Airways, yeah.
Yukon Airways. Who were the principals?
Bud Harbottle, Norm Hartnell, and then Ron Greenslade.
Ronnie Greenslade?
Ronnie Greenslade. He was Army Signals man. And Clyde Wan.
Wow.
And Harry Gordon Cooper. The two main guys were Harbottle and Hartnell.
Main guys, okay. And so when you sort of amalgamated with them, they all came on board with Whitehorse Flying Service? Or?
Yeah, that's right. And that was I never forgave our lawyer for that. He was a new lawyer, a fellow named George Van Ragen. He later became a senator and so on, but he screwed up to the point of where the harder George and I worked, the more money we made for these guys. And they didn't have a buyout clause in there. So we were really stuck, and they were sitting back. Well, Bud was working, and so was Norm. But business slacked off in the winter, and Norm finally left and went down to Kitimat, flew for the project down there. And I went to work in a body shop here, bashing metal. And George and Bud did the occasional flight that had come up. And so we finally decided, well, the hell of it, we'd sell. The only thing we could do was sell and get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was then, after that decision was made, George was killed.
In the FHA?
Yeah.
When I'm going to backtrack here a little bit, back with when you were with CPA, they were obviously, they had their 71s still, so they were doing charter work around around Yukon. I mean, who else was doing charter work then?
George Simmons.
George Simmons?
Yeah.
Anybody else?
No.
Harbottle and Hartnell, were they at
no,
it?
No, they came along about the same time as George and I did.
Right. And what were they flying? Do you remember? What
they? Yeah, they were flying a CB.
Right.
And Super Cruiser.
Mm-hmm. PA-12.
PA-12. And then they got rid of the CB because when we agreed to amalgamate, we didn't want have anything to do with it. It was a real dog. So they got rid of that, and they got a they'd ordered a Ronca sedan,
mm-hmm.
which is a pretty good little airplane. It's slower than hell, but.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So okay. Any other folks flying in around that period?
Pat Collison, after we bought Northern Airways out,
mm-hmm.
Herman Peterson went to Atlin and set up his air service, and Pat Collison went to Dawson and set up his air service.
Okay, so Pat went to Dawson in roughly 47, seems to me, 47, 48, something like that, wasn't it?
Could be. I used to go and do some work for Pat, like I'd change engines and renew his licenses and so on.
In Dawson?
And yeah, and he was in opposition to us
right.
when it come to bidding contracts and topographical survey stuff.
Right. So when did you get the first, can you talk about the first contract you guys got on the topographical surveys?
Yeah, that was with those Hiller 360s. Supporting. And the hell would that be?
So roughly 1949, somewhere in there.
Yeah, 50-51, I think it was.
Right.
50-51.
And that was with, you were at Whitehorse Flying Service
yep.
then.
Yep.
And so
Bud and I went down. We took our one Beaver and we went to work the contract all summer.
Right.
And we bought a Norseman, CFOBO, from the Ontario government. And it was a standby because our contract stated we must have two Beavers, or at least one Beaver with a standby of equivalent aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So the Norseman filled the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And we. We flew it, I think George flew it that summer, 210 hours, something like that. We paid.
George flew the
Norseman out of the Whitehorse base. And I think we paid $21,000 or something like that for it. Flew it 200 hours, took the radio out, and sold it for $25,000 to Queen Charlotte Airlines.
So, but meanwhile, you and Bud had the FHA, and you, what were you doing with that?
Topographical survey.
Right, so what was your role in that?
Well, I was the aircraft engineer, just
right.
keeping it flying.
And
I spelled out Bud with the flying.
You'd
right. take the loads out, and I'd fly the empty airplane.
Right, and you were flying...
food, mainly. Food and gas supplies, because we had to put out fly camps. And we'd moved the main camp, which was about a 16 or 18 man camp. And we'd move that every 10 days or so.
What region?
Where?
Sorry, what area?
North of Mayo.
Right.
Yeah, north of Mayo and Dawson. And right over into Mackenzie. Our last camp was on Caribou Lakes, I think it was. And we hauled gas out of Norman Wells. And we were at Carcajou Ridge, I guess. We were over doing a survey of Carcajou Ridge, which was by Sansu Rapids on the Mackenzie River. And we wound up in September at Cassiar Bar. Just on the 30 mile north of LaBarge.
Mm-hmm. And did you, so you were dedicated to that that summer? You got that contract? And that
all you were doing. That's right. That's all we were doing. Yeah. And flying every day.
And supporting their one or two helicopters?
Two.
Two Hiller, yeah. Hiller 360s.
Yeah.
And how many seasons did Waterhouse Flying Service have that kind of a contract?
I think we had it for 2 years. I didn't go on it the second year, but I think Pat Collison got it 1 year.
Right.
I think we had it 2 years.
Okay.